Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, mail-in voting, and I want to start with a big fact check here. When you hear President Trump saying that mail-in voting is fraudulent or unreliable or untrustworthy, don't believe it. The facts simply don't support that, and here's why. As the League of Women Voters asserts, mail-in voting is safe and it isn't new. The military has been doing it since the Civil War, and states have a lot of practice at it. As the U.S. Election Commission asserts, security procedures are in place from the time your ballot hits the mail to the time that it's counted. There are very few confirmed incidences of mail-in voter fraud. Mail-in voting increases voter turnout, and the numbers don't lie. And finally, as mentioned above, many states have experience with this, and they are preparing now. Minnesota's mail-in or absentee voting for the November election begins on September 18th, and your deadline for requesting that absentee ballot is November 3rd, Election Day. Now, does all of that mean, with millions more Americans needing and wanting to vote by mail because of the pandemic, that it will be completely smooth sailing? It does not, which is why we're here to answer your questions and your concerns this morning. How much confidence do you have in the security of mail-in voting? What are you concerned about when it comes to voting, whichever way you are going to vote in the national election? What do you want to know about the safety and the how-to of mail-in voting? 651-227-6000 on your questions about voting security and mail-in voting, 800-242-2828. What do you want to know about the how-to and the safety of it? And you can reach me on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Sean Morales Doyle, is a deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and he focuses on voting rights and elections. And we find him in Chicago. Sean, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me here.
Carol Anderson is with us, a political scientist and chair of African American Studies at Emory. She's also the author of One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Professor Anderson, welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Great talking with you.
So, Professor, I think we need to go right to this security issue, because I was a little startled to read a Gallup poll that was taken from 2019. 59% of Americans say they lack confidence in the security of elections, and mail-in voting was part of that. Now, of course, this is pre-pandemic, before we knew that so many of us might be voting by mail. What do you think contributes to the concerns that Americans are expressing, particularly about mail-in voting?
I think it really boils down to the politicians who have a vested interest in creating confusion and a sense of the lack of security in our voting procedures by consistently yammering on about voter fraud. When, as you noted at the beginning, the data, the evidence simply does not bear that out. So it is a political ploy to depress voter turnout. If people believe that the elections are rigged, if people believe that their votes won't count, then there's a question about why exert the effort to vote. So it's not about reality. It is about a political theater.
Yeah, Sean, I think we have to, as I said in the introduction, I think we have to acknowledge that we have never had a president, a commander in chief, who raises the kinds of questions about the security of our voter institutions. And we just can't ignore the impact that that's having. I'd like to know how you know, what you're observing about that from your position at the Brennan Center.
Well, as you say, it's really damaging. I mean, our democracy functions because people believe in it. They have faith in it. They believe that they should go out and vote, as Professor Anderson just said. And the president, when he makes these attacks based on fictional claims, it undermines people's confidence. It undermines those institutions. And that's why it's so important that we respond with truth and reality, that we spread that reality far and wide so people understand it, so that people won't be misled by these kinds of claims. And, you know, there are real reasons to be concerned about how smoothly our elections are going to go this year.
Right.
And we should be working on them. They're just not the reasons that the president is pointing to. It's not voter fraud, which is, you know, vanishingly rare, but it's about ramping up a massive vote by mail system in the next few months in a country that has certainly done plenty of voting by mail before, but hasn't done it at this scale. And, you know, preparing for in-person voting in the midst of a pandemic. We have work to do, but it's not because our institutions don't work or they're failing or because of fraud or nefarious misconduct. It's just the work of administering large-scale elections.
Professor Anderson, a little housekeeping here, if you will. When the president recently has been talking about being concerned about the unreliability or the fraudulence of mail-in voting, he seems to be pointing to universal mail-in voting. I think it'd be worthwhile giving our listeners the specifics of what the difference is. Some states do universal mail-in voting. Other states just have mail-in voting. What's the difference?
And the difference is in that key word, universal. So universal mail-in voting is where that is how the system is run. Everybody votes via the mail for the most part. For mail-in voting, that means that you've got the option to use your absentee ballot, or that you can do physically go to the polls and vote. But what he's doing is he's conflating terms, and even in the conflation of the terms, he's got it all wrong. Sean just really nailed it in that we have to be concerned about scaling up, given that we're in a pandemic, that we can make in-person voting as safe as possible, as well as have the gears rolling for the massive increase in the need for mail-in ballots. That's where our focus should be. And so he's distracting and detracting at the same time.
Again, just to emphasize this, only a small number of states at the moment, Sean, send out ballots, requested or not, universal mail-in voting. Do you wish more states did that, by the way?
I think that it has proven to work well in the states that have done it, but
okay.
Those states did it after putting in the work to make it happen. I think there are not a lot of places in the country that are ready to do that kind of thing right now. And so I guess it's not going to happen before November, most places in the country. And so instead of worrying about a universal vote by mail system, we need to be worrying about how elections are going to work in those states right now, which will mean a big increase in voting by mail.
Right.
But certainly very important that all of those states that aren't going to have universal vote by mail, because it's just not feasible, making sure that they're going to have in-person options available to people. There are still going to be lots of people voting in person this year, and we need to be ready for that part of it, too.
Elizabeth says on Twitter, voter suppression. We're going to talk about this more. I'm going to the polls, hell or high water. I'm sure machines can be hacked, but I believe that physically handing a paper ballot to an election official and watching it scan gives me a decent shot of being counted accurately. Ethan says, I'm not worried. My Ramsey County absentee ballot for the primary was delivered within 10 days of my requesting it. Vote was verified and accepted 2 days after I mailed it back. Plan ahead. Leave yourself time to the phones to Trish in Robbinsdale. Hi, Trish. You work as an election judge? That's terrific.
Yeah. We appreciate participating in the process, and it really is very insightful to see people come in to vote, and it's interesting to see what motivates them to do so. My concern more so, what I witnessed this past Tuesday, my significant other works in a different ward, and he witnessed it on a larger scale, is that people would come in, we would explain to them that it is a primary election, so you're only allowed to vote within one party. You can't cross over to other parties. We had 443 people show up to cast their vote, and 75 ballots were spoiled because they marked their ballot and typically would overvote, and that is to say cross over when they shouldn't have.
I see.
That's okay. We can give them another ballot and spoil the one that they misvoted with. In my significant other's ward, they had 150 voters mark their ballots incorrectly out of 476.
So, Trish, if I might, these are voters who did not understand that they couldn't vote across parties in a primary. Is that right?
Correct. Okay. Even though we were very, very clear that once you are in a column, you must stay in that column and vote for the candidates within that party.
Okay.
That's my concern.
Okay, good. I'm really glad you called, and thanks for the work as an election judge. Professor Anderson, some of this, I think, is voter day education. And who would undertake that kind of education? Is that up to secretaries of state governments?
You see it happening in multiple places. So, yes, the Secretary of State should have that, but a lot of folks don't hit the Secretary of State's webpage. You see lots of civic organizations stepping up to do the kind of civic education that needs to happen. And you have, as well, in the schools, that should be happening. But still, and this is why you need the kind of buffer space to be able to give people the time to correct the error so that their vote will count. This has been one of the issues with the absentee ballots, is to make sure that this is the thing with like registration and absentee ballots, to make sure that people have the time to correct errors before it gets spoiled and discarded.
And Professor Anderson, the way that might work is you plan far enough ahead to do your mail-in ballot. It's received, and the people that are receiving and presumably counting notice that you've made some kind of an error, and they get in touch with you, and then you have an opportunity to correct it. Is that right?
That is correct. And that's really important, because sometimes, I mean, you think about how many forms you've signed where you didn't sign this one page. It can be things as simple as that. Right. And so having the time to correct a simple error means that your vote counts.
Sean, while we're talking about signing here, we got a call from Steve in Grand Marais, who says, I'm 73 years old. I'm living alone. It's hard to get a witness to sign your ballot. I think it'd be better to verify with your Social Security number. I know Wisconsin does this. And Minnesota does this. Is that pretty much universal, that you need a witness to sign the ballot?
No, it's actually a minority of states that require a witness, or some states a notary public. And it's a particularly significant obstacle when we're in the midst of a pandemic, obviously, because people like that caller don't have folks around that can serve as a witness. Most states use other methods for verifying and confirming people's mail-in ballots, like signature matching, when people mail their ballot in with their own signature, because there's a signature on file for every registered voter already. And it works just fine. So as long as that's done well, I mean, there are issues with that as well, but it is a much more, a much less burdensome system than requiring people to have a witness to their mail ballot. I think this is one, you know, Minnesota generally is a state that's doing pretty well on a lot of the policies,
right,
that we recommend to prepare for voting in a pandemic and voting more generally. There's definitely still some places where there's room for improvement, and that's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I just got a note here from our political reporter, Brian Bax, who reminds me the Minnesota Supreme Court is considering a legal challenge around absentee ballot rules for the November general election. Because of the pandemic, a requirement that people voting remotely get a witness to certify their eligibility has been suspended, and that was the result of a consent decree reached between the Secretary of State and groups who argued that it was an undue burden. Ramsey County judge signed off on it, as well as one making ballots postmarked by Election Day eligible for counting in the days after. So we'll have some news on that before the November election. This is a conversation this morning to quell some of the concerns that have been stirred up by President Trump and others, some governors, some secretaries of state, about the security of voting. The president has said multiple times that mail-in voting is fraudulent or unreliable or trustworthy. We're starting the show today saying, do not believe that. The facts don't support it. That said, there is some influence of institutions that may be undermined, that may affect the way that mail-in voting, absentee voting goes in this pandemic election. And so Carol Anderson is with us, a political scientist and chair of African American Studies at Emory. She's an expert on voting and voting suppression. And Sean Morales Doyle is with us, deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. And I'm asking you how much confidence you have in the security of mail-in or absentee voting. What do you want to know about the safety and the how-to of mail-in voting? And then, of course, I want to hear your concerns about voter suppression, because Carol Anderson is an expert on that, and we're going to talk about it in a moment. So here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, to Dave in Minneapolis. Hi, Dave. Hey, Dave, are you there? Okay, we're going to go to Wayne in Proctor, Minnesota. Hi, Wayne, what's your question about this?
I want to make a comment. You know, St. Louis County, we have unorganized precincts, and they've been mailing in voting for decades.
Uh-huh.
And then the other thing was the U.S. Postal Service.
Yep.
I'm hearing they're doing cutbacks and such. I voted absentee for the primary and would verify it on Secretary of State. But I'm just wondering, you know, will the ballots actually make it to the polling place?
Yeah. What about all of this that we're hearing about what's happening with the U.S. Postal Service? Professor Anderson, can I go to you first on that, and then we'll hear from Sean. What are your concerns about this?
Oh, major. So that Trump installed one of his key campaign donors to be the head of the post office, who issued an order to slow down delivery, to cut back overtime, to remove sorting equipment. And it's clear that what this is designed to do is to destabilize one of the key mechanisms for mail-in ballots. And you couple that with the Supreme Court decision that came out of Wisconsin in April, RNC versus DNC, that said that the ballot has to be postmarked by the day of election in order to count. So if you can slow down the delivery system, so this is a deliberate attempt by the Trump administration to hobble one of the key delivery mechanisms for the vote. And so this is why we have to push back on this. We have to get, as he said yesterday, he's holding the funds in the CARES Act that the post office needs, because if the post office doesn't get that money, then they just can't deliver these ballots. And so this is deliberate. And this is why some of the alternates to this are the drop boxes that the Secretary of State and the Boards of Elections have, where you can actually put your ballot in the drop box. And that way you can circumvent being able to have to drop it off in the mail. But people, as I've heard, people are willing to crawl through broken glass this election in November in order to vote.
Sean, we've got a tweet here that I think applies to what Professor Anderson just said. What about the Postal Service? Why isn't Congress doing something? What about people's medications and Social Security checks? What is the remedy, if there is one, for what's happening with the Postal Service? And I do want to ask, taking in what Professor Anderson said, are these concerns overblown? Or do you share her deep concern about how the Postal Service could slow everything down?
Definitely share concern. I think we are going, it's an institution we, as that tweet points out, it's an institution we rely on for so many things that are crucial to our way of life and our health and everything else. It is also an institution that we will be leaning on very heavily this election. And so it is definitely concerning to see, signs that it's being undermined or underfunded. Congress should do what's necessary to ensure that it's got the resources it needs. Congress also, by the way, should do what's necessary to ensure elections administrators have the resources they need to run this election. And I will just say, one of the solutions to mail moving slowly, et cetera, is for states to come up with the voter-friendly policies that they need to in order to allow for votes to count in this election. And that includes things like what you mentioned before, accepting ballots that arrive after election day, so long as they're postmarked on time, something that's done in many states. It is not the law in Minnesota, but there is litigation going on about that. But there are ways for elections to be structured that make them not depend so much on the speed with which mail is delivered. That includes extending deadlines. That includes, as Professor Anderson said, providing for drop boxes. That includes making sure that in-person polling is available to people in a way that's safe and sanitary. It would obviously be better if we had a fully functioning postal service, and I hope we do. But we need to be prepared for, even without the undermining of an institution, we need prepared for the fact that we're going to be putting much more of a strain on that system this year's election than in elections past. And so policies need to be adjusted to account for that.
Yeah. Let me say something about the lock boxes here. Professor Anderson, I've been reading about some secretaries of states or legislators trying to outlaw the use of those lock boxes. So I don't know how many voters are going to have that available to them.
And this is part of the kind of structure of voter suppression. I liken it to the massive poll closures that we witnessed after the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County v. Holder decision in 2013. Mm-hmm. So almost 1,700 polls were closed, which meant then that access to communities, because those poll closures happened overwhelmingly in minority and poor communities. So issue of access to the ballot box became jeopardized by that structure. And so now in the midst of a pandemic, what we're doing is you have some public officials who, just like in the era of Jim Crow, are compelling people to have to make a choice. You either vote and protect that right, or you don't vote so that you can be safe. Vote or die. Vote or die. In a democracy, That is not the kind of Hobson's choice we should ever put before American citizens. And so this move to restrict the location and access to drop boxes in the middle of a pandemic, when the post office is being undermined, when the Postal Service has just issued an order that ballot, the postage on ballots will basically almost triple, which is going to cost more for the state. When we have all of this happening, we need to have the kind of response that, as Sean said, is really about how do we provide free and fair elections in the midst of a pandemic. That should be the question before our public officials. And when they answer with witnesses and removing drop boxes or not having enough and not enough polling stations, then we know that that is a commitment to not have a democracy.
Tracy says on Twitter, I don't worry about the security of the process as much as I worry about the expected surge in mail-in ballots and the ability of the post office to handle it. I voted by mail in the primary, and in Minnesota, at least, the process seemed very above board and confirmable. One of the things that you hear our guests saying this morning is if you are going to vote by mail-in ballot, give yourself lots of time. Give yourself a big buffer to, should there be an error, maybe you didn't sign something you needed to sign or there was a problem some other way, give yourself time to either have that ballot returned to you, to track the ballot, and so that you make sure that your ballot counts. Conversation this morning about voting security with Carol Anderson of Emory and Sean Morales Doyle of the Brennan Center for Justice. And your calls and questions about the confidence that you have in the security of mail-in voting and voting overall. I noted at the beginning of the show, 59% in a Gallup poll of respondents said that they are worried about the security and it lacked confidence, I should say, in the security of elections. And mail-in voting and voter suppression is a big part of that. So we're talking about how institutions can come up with remedies for that and how individual voters can come up with remedies for that. 651-227-6000 to join the conversation, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. To Allison in Edina. Hi, Allison. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking my call.
What are you thinking about?
I grew up in Oregon, which is a universal mail-in state. So for me, that iconic voting with your parents meant we drove up and dropped off my parents' ballot at a ballot box. And so I enjoy telling people who are worried about mail-in voting that that was all I ever knew until moving to the Midwest. But I also worry about the infrastructure that we don't necessarily have in place. You've been talking so much about needing to give yourself extra time, needing that, you know, cushion. And I worry that does Minnesota, I don't even know, do we have drop-off boxes like Professor Anderson has talked about? Do I have that availability to, at the last minute, still vote? Or is that it's either premeditated and mail-in in Minnesota or it's in person? Is there anything
in between? I believe that you can drop off your ballot if you voted, you know, mail-in. You can drive to the polling place or to a center, not to your polling place. Sorry about that. To an election center to drop it off. Now, is there a receptacle there? I don't know about that. Maybe if Brian Baxter is still listening, he'll inform me on that. But your point about infrastructure is a really good one. And Sean, to you on what else is missing in our voter infrastructure that might make a difference for the concerns that we're hearing today?
Well, I mean, it varies around the country. In some places, what we're missing is a good plan and all the PPE necessary for running safe and sanitary in-person voting. In some places, what we're missing are, as I mentioned before, good rules and plans for handling a large influx of mail voting, you know, enough people to count and canvass the mail ballots. So we don't see some of the delays that we saw in New York recently, for instance. It usually, though not always, comes down to resources for elections officials. I mean, elections officials around the country know how to run good elections, but they need the resources to do that. And that's why we've been really pushing hard for Congress to provide additional funding in the stimulus package for elections. There just needs to be a lot more distributed down to the local level for these elections to go smoothly.
Professor Anderson, you're probably tracking this. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar is a lead sponsor on a bill that would require that states expand early voting margins to 20 days before the election. It's being blocked by GOP Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, at least last time I checked. What would that legislation make a big difference, or would you try to put, you know, your emphasis, if there's going to be legislation before the election, on something else?
I think it's part and parcel of a package of increasing access to the ballot box. And so in a pandemic, being able to have 20 days prior to the election, what that does is it allows people to not have to be packed in. And so you can get more of the kind of social distancing that you need,
right,
in order to keep people safe. And so, yes, but there is a whole series of voting initiatives that are really just sitting on the desk of Mitch McConnell right now. As he said, it's going to be the graveyard. He sees these things as a power grab instead of as access to the ballot box for American citizens. So, yes, we need to have expanded early voting. After Shelby County v. Holder, in many states, those early voting days were cut because working class folk, African-Americans were using early voting disproportionately to their numbers in the voting age eligible population. And so those days were cut. And we're facing the ramifications of that. So I think Senator Klobuchar's bill is necessary, as is the funding that these local election boards need in order to run smooth and fair elections.
Jane in Duluth called. She says, I was sent several applications for mail-in ballots from different interest groups, and that was really confusing. I had to call the county to understand what it was all about. I agree that when you vote by mail, there's an increased chance you'll spoil your ballot. Sean, I assume that what Jane was getting in the mail were sample ballots from interest groups, not real ballots that she'd be able to use to vote. Am I wrong about that?
It sounds like she might have been getting ballot applications.
I see. Okay.
To request a mail-in ballot, which sometimes non-governmental actors do send out. And I do think it, depending on how well they do it, it can be confusing. And, you know, I think this question of ballot spoilings come up a couple times. I do think that, you know, this is, again, I'm referencing New York in part because that's where I vote, but also because the elections in recent memory there, this was a problem there, that there were a lot of mail-in ballots that were rejected because of, you know, someone forgot to sign it or didn't do something quite right on the ballot envelope. And that is, I think, not necessarily a bigger problem in mail voting. It is probably going to be a bigger problem in places where people aren't used to voting by mail.
Yeah.
And that is another place where we need to see policy change to ensure that people have an opportunity to fix those kind of curable small mistakes, right? There's no reason a ballot needs to be rejected because someone forgot to sign it or because their signature looks a little bit different if it really is their signature. And so, elections officials need to have the opportunity to provide that person notice and give them a chance to fix whatever problem may stop their vote from counting. That's something that many, many states do. And it's really important, as we're seeing, you know, a huge influx in the number of people who are voting by mail and doing it for the first time ever. And that's another place where Minnesota could actually improve their policy.
Okay, call here from Jim in North Branch. Hi, Jim. What are you wondering about? Hi.
Quick question. When I go to on election day to vote, my name is on a piece of paper. They check my ID, and then they check it off that I voted. If I vote early or mail in vote, is there a process where my name isn't on that sheet of paper anymore, so I can't go in and vote again?
So you wouldn't. So is there some process so you wouldn't be allowed to double vote?
Exactly.
Vote twice. Professor Anderson, can you answer that?
Yes, there is. So that when you so here in Georgia, if you do an absentee ballot, you are registered as doing an absentee ballot. And so then if I try to go in and vote in person, it would ping up, oh, you have already voted absentee. So that the processes are already in place to catch those sorts of things. But this is, again, why the narrative of massive rampant voter fraud just cannot be borne out by the evidence, because election officials have put these security guidelines and guardrails in place already.
Professor, one other thing I wanted to mention here. There are surprisingly still a handful of states that require some kind of an excuse for an absentee ballot. And I'm wondering if the coronavirus is going to be the acceptable excuse in many of those states this time around. What are you seeing on that?
We saw what happened in Texas. Texas, for instance, has that life. You don't need an excuse for an absentee ballot. But if you are younger than 65, you have to have an excuse to get an absentee ballot. And the Secretary of State and the courts have ruled that fear of contracting COVID-19 is not a valid excuse.
Wow.
For requesting an absentee ballot. Yeah.
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 A call here from Rhoda in St. Paul. Hi, Rhoda.
Hi. I also work as an election judge.
Ah, well done.
I've been a head judge at a precinct here in St. Paul for 12 years.
Good. I'm glad you called.
So, yeah. So concerning voter suppression, I think your expert has talked about polling places being closed because there have not been enough people to work, and that's happened twice. It happened in Wisconsin in the primary. It happened in Milwaukee, I believe.
Right.
And in Atlanta as well. And that's really important. It's so important that we have enough people who will work the November election, especially because of the demographic of those of us who do this regularly. You know, we're old people. And so voter suppression will occur if we do not have enough people to staff all those polling places. And it's especially important in Minnesota because we have same-day voter registration,
right?
Which is one of the great things about living in Minnesota. And, Tuesday was an extremely slow day because so many people voted by mail.
For
and
the primary.
In my precinct, there was no big thing on the ballot. But I know that November, we will have crowds. And we will have an endless line of people who need to register to vote that day.
Okay, so if I've got you, Rhoda, you'd like our guest to make the case for signing up to be an election judge. And Professor Anderson, is she right that this is also a form of voter suppression if you simply can't get enough judges to open enough polling places? So what's your most persuasive argument for why people ought to do that?
And so she's right. In Milwaukee, in the April primary, 175 of 180 of the polling places were closed. So
wow.
There were only 5 polling places for all of Milwaukee in the April 7th primary. And this is why, one of the reasons why we see the line. The other reason was because the request for absentee ballots was exponentially higher than it had been before. So the state wasn't able to get those ballots into the hands of the voters in time. And so when the Supreme Court said on April 6th that if your ballot has to be postmarked by April 7th, and people, tens of thousands of people still hadn't received their ballots, mm-hmm. that sent them out into those lines with only five polling places, for instance, in Milwaukee. And so one of the things that's being done is that you have groups who are organizing young folk, organizing students, and sending students through the process of the training that you need in order to be an election judge, to be a poll worker. That's one of the processes, but we also need to make sure that we have the protective gear in place for them so that we're not putting them in harm's way. So yes, we have to have poll workers. Yes, we have to have the protective gear. And yes, we have to have more early voting days. And yes, we have to have the resources. And yes, because this is a democracy, we must do all of this.
Sean, do you think college students are a good potential pool to try to get more election judges trained and ready to go on election day? Is that a good place to go for this?
Absolutely. I mean, first, I just want to say thank you to both of the callers that called in that are already serving as election judges and to all of the people who are doing that. This is how our elections work. It's, you know, regular citizens stepping up and taking part in the process. They do it every year, but obviously have even more respect for folks who are doing it in this time in the midst of the pandemic. But just as your caller mentioned, it's important that we not rely on the most vulnerable populations in our society to do that.
Right.
It's important that younger people step up. And I think that college students, you know, people who aren't in college, young people absolutely should get involved this way. I think it can be a really rewarding experience. It also helps all of us understand how elections really function, how this all works, how our country runs. And so I would encourage young people across the country to do that kind of work. And then I wholeheartedly agree with Professor Anderson that, of course, that also means that we give them the support that they need to ensure that they're safe and ensure that they're able to do their jobs. We give them the training they need to run elections the right way and in a time when the rules are honestly changing. We have a plan in place with backup workers, with backup polling places, because the worst thing that can happen, it's not just the closing of polling places, it's last minute changes in closing of polling places. You know, people have to adjust
yeah.
to too many things already
That's
to go vote.
That's confusing.
And finding out at the
Absolutely.
Last minute that your polling place is closed can really lead to a lot of people not voting. And that's what we need to be worried about.
Mark says on Twitter, my wife and I both received unsolicited a mostly filled out absentee ballot application from the Center for Voter Information. This was a red flag, kind of creepy, seems legit. So, Sean, again, let's focus on this for just a minute. These are applications for an absentee ballot sent out by special interest groups. And in Mark's case, he says it was mostly filled out. Is there anything, there's nothing illegal about what they're doing with this, right?
Right. I mean, I think it's important that we talk carefully about these things, because even I sometimes, when I'm moving quickly, will say ballot when I mean ballot application. And this isn't a ballot filled out with votes or anything like that. This
right.
is an application to the state to say, please send me a mail ballot so that I can vote by mail this year. And, you know, people who are registered to vote, their information is available publicly so that we know who's on the rolls. And so you could send someone a ballot application with their information on it and say, here, you should mail this in and vote by mail. Oftentimes these are nonpartisan organizations, that the one that he just mentioned is a nonpartisan organization. So but I do understand why it can feel kind of creepy to people. And I do think it can be confusing. So, it's important that folks that are doing that kind of work are doing so carefully. And it's also why ideally you have the government doing this. And that's happening in a lot of places around the country where people aren't being mailed ballots directly, as in the universal vote by mail states. A lot of jurisdictions, and we would encourage more jurisdictions, are mailing ballot applications directly to every registered voter. And we think that's great. And then people don't have to have that concern about why am I getting this thing, because it's coming from the Board of Elections. And
right.
You know exactly how legitimate it is.
Let me grab a call here from Dave in Andover. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well. What'd you want to add to this?
Well, I've got 2 points and then a question. First off, the U.S. Post Office is the only agency where you can send classified information. So the government can send up to secret information through the Post Office.
Okay. What's your second point? I'm a little short on time.
Okay. Wasn't there a commission shortly after the election on fraud, and they found nothing?
Yes.
The last point, during the when they do absentee ballots, isn't a member of both major parties able to review some of the ballots as well?
Good question. So, Professor Anderson, we hear about ballots being thrown out, right? Who is making those decisions? And is Dave right that there are, members of different parties involved in making those decisions?
I'm going to throw that one actually to Sean.
Okay. Sean, good. Give us the procedure here. How does that work?
Yeah. Exactly how it works. But the basic answer is yes. The campaigns, the parties, other poll watchers are involved in making sure, are there to monitor and make sure that the canvass, that the day of election procedures, the mail balloting and the canvassing are all done above board. We do have a lot of transparency in this system. And so sometimes ballots are rejected because a party or a campaign challenged a ballot. They say that ballot doesn't, the signature doesn't match, or the signature is missing or whatever on an absentee ballot. And then ideally what you have, and it varies a little bit from state to state, are multiple election officials. Basically, you'd have to have agreement from multiple people that there is a defect before a ballot would be set aside. But that is not always why ballots are being rejected. Sometimes they're being rejected just because on initial review, a signature is missing or some technical defect, like I've mentioned before, not because someone necessarily challenged it. And that's why both of these are reasons why you need to have this notice and cure process in place, so that a voter can be told, you forgot to sign your envelope. Was this really you? And then they can fill out an affidavit and say, yes, it was me. Please count my ballot. There's absolutely a process in place across the country to make sure that valid ballots are being counted and invalid ballots are being set aside. We hope that those processes work to ensure that most ballots are being counted and that the ones being set aside are the rare occasion when nothing can be done.
Jose says on Twitter, I'm an election judge as well. I had a couple of people this primary who came in just to check if their absentee ballot was counted. Our polling pads automatically showed an absentee vote in place. Big smiles all around. And then Brian reminds me, I didn't know this, ages 16 and up can be election judges. Great opportunity for high school students. See the Minnesota Secretary of State website. Wouldn't that be cool if we persuaded a number of college and high school students to become election judges this time around? Professor Anderson, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being part of the conversation today.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Sean, good to meet you, and keep up the good work here at focusing on voting rights and elections. Thank you much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. More conversations to come, of course, on voting as we count down, I think, 82 days to go to the November election. I hope you'll stay tuned in.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.